Hello, dear friends. Greg Kuchel here, and the show is Stand to Reason. Glad you've joined me today. I have just finished a magnificent interview with Stephen Meyer, and the way that this is all working out is you get this first, and then you get that second. So this show comes out on Wednesday, and the next show with Stephen Meyer on his new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, will be with you on Friday. I was wondering during that whole interview, I mean, this is just a little crazy idiosyncrasy. I'm hearing a buzzing during the entire interview. Now, I'm hard of hearing, but I hear this noise, and Amy is the noise Nazi. I mean, she picks up every little thing, and I'm thinking, how come I can hear this and she can't hear it? What's going on here? And as I'm just getting ready to put my headsets on now for this hour, I realized all last hour I had my hearing aids in. And so I'm getting feedback in my own head from my own hearing aids. When I just pulled them out as the music came up, I put my headset on and no buzzing. Well, anyway, I think that's funny whether you do or not. Glad you're on the show with me or listening to the show. Just a quick word. I've got a couple things I want to start out with, and I have calls coming up, but a quick word about that interview. And just to prep you, since it's coming up next hour for you, Friday, when you get this, Black Friday, I guess it's going to be, is when it comes live for you, available for you. I'm thinking of a very famous quote by Richard Dawkins, and I've used it before to demonstrate what follows naturally from materialism. And the citation is, in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. Well, that's true as far as it goes, if you are stipulating this kind of universe, all right? And then he says, the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Well, that statement is demonstrably false, because the first statement is a philosophic statement that is, given this kind of universe, here's what follows. And I guess you would say no evil, no good from the second sentence would follow also. But this part of the second sentence, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, that's demonstrably false. And that's what I love about Stephen Meyer's book, Return of the God Hypothesis, because everywhere we look now in science, we find that that is false. When I say everywhere we look, I should qualify it. Because most of what science does is manipulation of things and discovery of things that are already kind of in motion. But if you look at the original things, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, you look at the fine-tuned constants of the universe, these are the three big, massive areas that are dealt with by Stephen Meyer in his book. You get it demonstrates that this statement by Richard Dawkins is false. The universe that we observe is precisely the properties that we should expect if there is design, if there is purpose. Anyway, that's what the interview is about. Hope you listen to it. Next show coming up for you. I'm still buzzed from my weekend now, the weekend before last in Minneapolis. We had 3,200 people in that event, mostly middle schoolers and high schoolers. There were some old folks, parents, grandparents, youth leaders that snuck in because we weren't checking IDs. It was a fabulous, unbelievable event. This particular church holds more than 4,000 people. When you have 3,200 in there, that looks pretty full. All right, there's going to be some empty places, but not many. And it was a thunderous kind of experience when everybody was together worshiping aggressively and then going through all the plenary and the workshops. It was magnificent, all right? And this particular series, because we do We do our realities for a school year season, as it were, three in the fall and three in the spring. They're all the same. Same speakers, same ideas, same theme, all of that. And when we do it that way, that gives us a chance to refine our presentations. And so our poor Orange County crowd gets the dress rehearsal because they're first up, right? Then we go to Seattle. We improved a little bit more. I think by the time we hit Minneapolis, we really had hit our stride with this. So that means in February in Dallas, the 25th and 26th, we're going to be on our marks there. And Philadelphia, March 15th, make that March 25th and 26th. And then Augusta, Georgia, April 22nd and 23rd. So mark your calendars if you're within striking distance of those events. There's something that I read, though, that in a book last night. It's a biography of Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was a saint of the 20th century in England. He was Welsh and gained renown as a preacher there in England and wrote some magnificent books on the Book of Romans. And so if you haven't read any of Lloyd-Jones, I encourage you to do so. But there, part of what he was significant in contributing to was a kind of generalized revival in the UK, because at that time you had what you would probably call now progressives. You had a lot of people that did not take the authority of the Bible seriously, and in fact called, just like now, if you take it seriously and cite it as the Word of God, that you're accused sometimes of bibliolatry. You are worshiping this thing here instead of God when you treat it as the inerrant, inspired Word of God. And there's a lot of young people attracted to this movement because of the general, what's the word, malleability, softness. I'm searching for words. You know, it's the old ways are too harsh. They're too severe. They're too narrow. And let's, you know, get a kinder and gentler gospel that is more human and less judgmental and not as much of nasty, angry God and all of that. Of course, this eviscerates the true gospel, because the true gospel entails a solution to a serious problem, and it's a serious problem that we all have. And the problem, in a certain sense, is not sin. It's certainly an element of it. I mean, it's a vital element to this analysis, but the problem is what sin results in before a holy God, and that is we have culpability and we answer to God. And when we answer to a holy God, we are on the block and we are found guilty, and that is not a pretty picture. And so the solution for God's justice is mercy that is accomplished in a very particular way. And that is Jesus, God himself, actually receiving the justice that we deserve. He receives it on himself. He makes a trade so that we are then in a position to receive the grace and the merit that Christ trades with us. He gets our punishment. We get his goodness. He gets our badness. We get his goodness. He gets our punishment. We get his merit. Okay, that's how that kind of goes together. Anyway, so this is, you know, what goes around now, the younger crowd, the progressive church. They're not all young, but it's appealing because of the cultural pressure. So in light of that, what we see now, I want to read something from this biography of Martin Lloyd-Jones about an event that happened on May 24th, 1941. So this is the middle of the war, where it went from 39 to 45. And Lloyd-Jones is preaching in a circumstance much like I just described. Well, actually, that's the point I'm getting to. I'll read the piece. I just want to let you know that when free church is referred to here, at least these particulars that are being referred to, it's this more progressive group that is being characterized here. So my two paragraphs here from this piece, and then I'll make my point in a simple way, basically set it up for you. Here's what it says. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, Lloyd-Jones has preached, and this is a response to the preaching. It's a characterization of the message. So here's what it says. Dr. Lloyd-Jones saw the need today of preaching that led to conversion, an opinion evoking marked approval from the audience at large there. Methodists must think more carefully over the discrimination between the once-born and the twice-born, this piece says. Attendance at worship or even official service did not necessarily mean that something had come to a man that had an inward reality and a power in his life. Decision may not mean conversion. Just because you walk forward, just because you sit in church, even if being in the ministry, that doesn't mean you're converted, is the point here. Continues, the tragedy of the pulpit was that ministers were not preaching a converting gospel. Now, this is the summary of what Lloyd-Jones was saying. We need a converting gospel. We need a real gospel, God's word, to transform people. Now, there's a reaction to this. And here it cites the reaction. The younger generation of Free Church ministers, and a number of the older, were certainly not in favor of any return to the old message. The old message, the reactionary message, the, you know, old-time religion is what Lloyd-Jones was offering, a renewal. Oh, no, we don't want to go backwards. And then they cite two people who were united, two well-known people at that time, who were united in the conviction that it was stern views of God which were the supreme reason for the alienation of the people from Christianity. And they were ready to blame bibliolatry for the existence of such wrong ideas of God. You don't get it, they're saying. Lloyd-Jones, you don't get it. That's old school. We got new school now. Your old school stuff, that just scares people away. That annoys people. That's why young people aren't coming to your events. That's why they're going away. They want something new and fresh and not so stern and not so Bible-centered, bibliolatry. And that's where they're getting all these wrong ideas about God is driving them away. I thought this was really interesting for me to read last night. So I was, you know, just before, as I was in bed, I read three or four pages of this and then drift off. But I thought it was interesting in light of the fact that we just came from an event in Minneapolis that had 3,200 young people. In fact, Alan took a magnificent photo from way up in the high reaches of this thing, and they had double balconies. I mean, you have the whole bottom floor going sweeping up into the back as big places usually do. Then you had a balcony above that and another one. He was only on the first balcony, so you couldn't see the people in the top balcony. You also couldn't see about at least 25% of the gallery because of the angle of the photo. Nevertheless, it was a sea of people. And he sent out a tweet, and some of you might have seen it. And it said something to the effect of, people are saying young people don't care about apologetics. Well, here's 3,200 young people that beg to differ, something to that effect. And, in fact, there are a bunch of young people who want a softer word, just like being spoken of here 75 years ago, mid-20th century in England. But that's not the truth. And it turns out, though there are many progressive types that are looking for another way out that isn't so, in their mind, stern or severe, God that's angry at sin, oh, please. Yet still, there are many who hunger for the truth. All right? And that's what we saw. That's what we saw. Last thought I have before a break and then to your calls here. And that's something about Thanksgiving, since you will receive this on Wednesday and Thanksgiving is on Thursday. And I want to make an observation. I want to make an observation about an interesting and I think plausible or not plausible. That's not the right word. This is certainly as plausible. I mean, somewhat compelling. Argument for God's existence based on Thanksgiving. Okay? And I don't mean the date. I mean the thing that we celebrate on the date, Thanksgiving. I remember hearing Michael Shermer once, the American Atheist Skeptic magazine. He said, I'm just thankful. I'm not thankful to anyone. I'm not thankful to anyone, I guess his point, like thankful to God. No, he doesn't believe in God. He's an atheist. I'm just thankful, okay? And I think he's missing something, all right? I think that he's thankful is really important and that he is not missing. It's an appropriate, the word that comes to mind is urge, but that's not really what I'm after. It's an impulse. It's an appropriate impulse, but what's going on there with that impulse? Okay, and I want you to think about this. There is really no such thing, practically speaking, as gratitude. In isolation, that is. We never have gratitude by itself. It's always, think about it, gratitude for or gratitude to. In other words, we're thankful for things. We're not just thankful. Doesn't make any sense to be, I'm thankful. Well, what are you thankful for? Who are you thankful to? So we are thankful to persons regarding the things we are thankful for. Like, pretty simple, not controversial. Thankful to my parents for raising me in a certain way, for example. Thankful to the founders of this country for creating a nation like ours. So you get the point. But if you think about it, there are some things that we naturally feel thankful for that no human being is responsible for. What now? I'm thankful I was born in the U.S., all right? I had parents who were responsible in one sense, but they were not responsible for me being here. They were just, in a certain sense, not me, Greg Kokel, this soul that inhabits this body. There was something else going on. I wouldn't say, hey, Mom, Dad, thank you that you were born in the United States so I could be born. That's not a merit by them. It's that I am here in this country that I am thankful for, but to whom am I thankful for that? All right? And so what I'm getting at is, and if you think about this a little bit more, you can come up with different angles on this, I guess. I think most of us properly feel thankful for many things that no human has given us. Yet, still, it seems we have been given it nonetheless. Ergo, Michael Shermer, the atheist, can say, I'm thankful. He feels the urge to be thankful, but in a certain sense, he can't finish the sentence. He can be thankful for, but he's not thankful to. And to be thankful for, kind of in the abstract without the to, who or what is giving this to you, to whom you are expressing gratitude, so it wouldn't be a what, it would have to be a who. Where is that one? Who is that one? Who is the proper object of our gratitude, simply put? So there's my miniature argument for God from the impulse to be thankful regarding things that we have, particularly those things for which no human being is responsible, yet there is someone to whom we feel gratitude. Just a thought. Let's go to break, and then we'll go to calls on Stand to Reason. Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love #STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. #STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, #STRAsk. That's #STRAsk.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
Well, I started this hour with no one on board. Thought I'd talk for a while. All of a sudden, the board lit up with all kinds of lights. So I'm going to jump into my callers. And this from Durango, Colorado, the one, the only Cade. Hello, Cade.
Hi, Mr. Kokel. How are you?
I'm doing great. And it's not only nice to talk to you now, but it was really nice to see you once again in Minneapolis a little more than a week ago at Reality. It was, and also to meet your brother and your mother and your friends. You made a long trip to go to that event, didn't you?
Yep. It was quite a long drive.
Yeah, from Durango. That's Colorado. That's Southern Colorado. I don't know if you're the person who drove the furthest, but you would be a candidate for that. Cade, so it was great to see you. It really was. So what's on your mind? Did you enjoy it, by the way? Let me ask you that. Silly question, right?
It was probably my favorite of the three that I have been to.
Uh-huh.
So, I really enjoyed that one.
Mm-hmm. Super. All right, so what's on your mind here, Cade?
So speaking of Reality Conference, when I came up and talked to you after the whole thing was over, we talked a little bit about critical race theory.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to delve into that a little more and maybe touch a little bit on social justice. So my first question is, what are some good definitions for critical race theory and social justice, and what's the difference between the two?
Okay, it's a really good question, and I'm thinking, do we have like an extra hour just to talk about these things? Because we did have a session on that I participated in with Monique Dusan, and we covered a little bit there, but there's so many questions that were unanswered, I think, and this is one reason you're calling. So it turns out that social justice is a component of critical race theory, but I want to make a qualifier at this point. I have been learning that the terminology critical race theory, CRT, is no longer useful. And the reason is, I mean, I'll talk about the substance, but I just want to make a comment here about the terminology. The reason is because there's been so much reaction to CRT being taught in all these school systems all over the place and in woke corporations, and it's descending like a dark cloud all over America. Dark cloud in my view, that the proponents of CRT have pulled back from that language. And so what they say now is, well, nobody knows exactly what CRT is. Lots of people have different views about what exactly critical race theory entails. And so we don't teach that. And what happens is this same general teaching, the substance of it, comes in under different headings like equity and inclusion, E&I. Instead of CRT, it's okay. EI. And there's a lot of other shadow enterprises that do the same thing. So what I want to do is, rather than just talk about CRT, whatever that is, I want to explain the broader sense, the broader ideology. And I'm going to give you four characteristics of it. And I get this from Neil Shenvey. And from what I've been able to determine, I think this is from all what I've read, I think this is a fair kind of characterization of a broad ideology that has descended upon our communities, all right? And the broad ideology, and I'll get to the CRT is critical race theory, so I'll get to the race part in just a bit, and then also the idea of social justice. The broad ideology is based on the notion that in civilization you have two competing groups or two distinguished groups, and that is the ruling class and the class that is being ruled. Let's just put it that way, okay? The ruling class and the class that is being ruled. Now, certainly we see things like that, but on this view, these are ultimate distinctions, the ruling class and the class that is being ruled. And people who know a little bit about Marxism know this is precisely the way Marx characterized society, the economics in society, and that is a political struggle between the bourgeoisie, the capitalists, ruling class, and the proletariat, which is the worker class. And the capitalistic ruling class were always exploiting the worker class, who were doing the work, and on his characterization, the capitalists were getting all the money. Okay, so this was unjust, and there needed to be he thought actually capitalism would die of its own weight, and a socialistic and then ultimately communistic country would come into play where there's equality. Now, what is equality? Well, it means everybody has the same. How does everybody get the same, basically? Well, there's a dictum in Marxist philosophy, and the dictum is from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. So you have an ability maybe to produce 10x, and here's a need of somebody who's not producing 10x. They have a need for 5x, so your five of your X is going to go, and that's cash basically, to this person in need. And this is just another way of saying the rich pay their fair share. You with me so far?
Yeah.
So there's a redistribution on this socialist system because there is, okay, now here I'm using two words in a very precise way. There is an inequity. And what inequity means is that people end up in different situations financially. Okay? The American system is based broadly on equality. And what that means is that we all get to start with the same rights and opportunities. Now, that's never been a perfect system, of course, but in general, the idea of equality is that we are all have equal opportunities. And that hasn't always been the case, but the laws, especially in the 60s, that were passed really, I think, guaranteed much more of that. But the problem is people still haven't ended up the same. You got richer people and you got poorer people, okay? And so there's no equity, all right? The goal of the communist system was equity. Everybody kind of ends up the same. We all share alike. We're all equal. We all get the same goods, basically, okay? So that's maybe an oversimplification, but I want you to see how that broader principle kind of gets translated into the circumstances we have today. You with me so far?
Yeah, you're basically saying, you're saying that the, like, social justice and CRT movements kind of stem from Marxist ideas.
Well, historically it flows from that, and they have some similarities.
Okay.
Marxist is narrowly construed in economics. Okay, what we see now is an expansion of these categories to include a whole bunch of other things, all right,
okay,
sociologically. So, but I want to go back to this basic concept of the ruling class and those that are being ruled. What I'm going to call that is the social binary, all right, that there is two groups of people, the ruling class, the ones ruled, or to use other language to describe it, there is the oppressor group that has power, and then there is the oppressed group that doesn't have power. That's the binary, oppressors versus oppressed. Now, what's really important is this is foundational to this entire way of looking at things, that you have this built-in structural oppressive system. All right? It's not argued for. It is asserted. This is the way everything is. All right. And so then the question is, the ones who are oppressors are the bad people, and the ones that are oppressed are the victims, and conversely, kind of the good people, because they didn't do the bad thing of oppression, they're being oppressed. This is the basic structure of what we're facing in all of these equity, inclusion, CRT, whatever, but they're just applied in different ways. Nowadays, sociologically, who are the oppressed? Well, the oppressed are people of color. The oppressed are people that don't have classical sexual desires. So that would be LGBT. They would be women who are oppressed by men. and et cetera, then, you know, or bisexual or transgendered rather, who now are oppressed because somebody is imposing the idea that transgender is not right, it's not natural, but rather there's binary sexuality. So these are all groups that you're aware of that kind of fall into the category of identity politics. Does that make sense so far?
Yes.
Okay, so all of these people are the oppressors, are the oppressed, and who is oppressing them? It's this other group that is in power. This group in power is the oppressor. So if people of color are being oppressed in virtue of being people of color, then it is people not of color, whites, that are doing the oppression. So the class of people, whites, are oppressing the class of people of color. And that's what is now called racism. It is being a member of a class of the power elite, which class has characteristically oppressed a different class of victims.
Power plus prejudice.
Prejudice is just a piece of it. And I don't know, did you read the piece that I wrote earlier this year called Critical Race Theory, Civil Rights Upside Down?
I believe I've seen it. I don't know if I've read the whole
thing.
Okay,
well, you go to our webpage. It's right at the bottom of the homepage, str.org.
Okay.
But there I say there's a series of things that went on that got reversed largely, or at least the attempt by Martin Luther King to reverse them, was there's bigotry that people had, and the bigotry was along racial lines. All right? Absolutely, no question about that. The bigotry led to a prejudice, okay? Let me see if... No, the bigotry was then seen in racial, along racial lines, became racism. So if a white person has bigotry towards a black person, he thinks he's better, but he thinks he's better because he's white and better than the black because he's black, okay? So that's where the racism comes in. It's like a group bigotry. And because of the racism, then there is a prejudice, a prejudging of people in the group that you're bigoted against. And so then blacks were considered, they had different, I'm not even going to say them because it might get me in trouble, but this was characteristically, people would say, oh, blacks are this or blacks are that. They would judge a black person who they don't even know based on the skin color, all right? And so they would just broad brush all blacks that way. So that's called prejudice. And this prejudice then led to discrimination. Now we can discriminate against them and withhold something that they is rightfully theirs. And this led to segregation. So you have those five things. And let me see if I can get them in the right order again. You have a bigotry that leads to racism, that leads to prejudice, that leads to discrimination, that leads to segregation. Okay, that was the dynamic of the civil rights movement of the late 50s and early 60s. Okay, but it became illegal to do that, at least discriminate in on the basis of those things, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Okay, so that kind of discrimination then largely became a thing of the past. And any place it was found, it was rooted out. All right, now there may be subtle remnants of that, and I'm not disagreeing with that, but I'm just trying to help you get the big picture, okay? So there's no social justice that's in play here now as part of the dialogue of the circumstance of the movement. Now we have something different because now we are not looking at individuals who have bigoted attitudes and therefore support prejudice and discrimination and segregation. Now we're looking at whole groups that have, according to certain power structures. So according to critical theory, it is the people that are in power as a group that oppress another group that is not in power, okay? And that group is white. So I, Mr. Kokol, on this view, am an oppressor just in virtue of the fact that I'm white because I'm part of this allegedly oppressive group that has always oppressed people of color. Now, notice we're just talking now about the people of color part. That's the racial piece of this puzzle. But, you know, there are also gays that are oppressed, and there are transgender that are oppressed, and there are women that are oppressed, et cetera, et cetera, and different religious groups that are oppressed, et cetera. And I'm mentioning these categories because they're important. I'll get to it in just a moment. So you have all these groups that are oppressed by this oppressor. And if it's racial, then the oppressor is the whites against the people of color. And that's where you get race, the race theory, critical race theory, broadly out of that. Okay. And the problem is there's not equity. Okay. So what you have here is you've got this social binary, the oppressor versus oppressed. That's not argued for. It's presumed. And that there are structural systems characteristic of the entire system. In other words, you can't reform this because it's built into the system. You have to tear the system down. This is what Marx proposed as well. And so since it's built into the system, the only way to rectify it is to get rid of the system. I mean, the Black Lives Matter founders were trained Marxists. This was their acknowledgement. Okay. So it shouldn't be surprising that some of this movement reflects that ideology. Okay. So how do you, and by the way, I mentioned ideology. This is the nature of oppression now. It's, and this is a characteristic of this broader thing, oppression by ideology. Now, Kate, maybe you remember seeing documentaries or things during the civil rights movement back in the 60s, and you saw signs that said no coloreds or whites only, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was oppression. In other words, people were not allowed in certain places, just like back to the back of the bus, right? They were oppressed in some physical way by being denied something that was rightfully theirs. That is not the picture of oppression now. Now it is oppression by ideology. And what that means is if you hold the view ideologically that, say, homosexuality is immoral, just simply holding the view and voicing it is an act of oppression. You are oppressing others by voicing an ideology that they are not comfortable with, that paints them as being wrong. That's called oppression by ideology. Now you begin to see why all of this silencing of speech that's going on in the name of equality or equity, in the name of this movement, because people are talking in a way that make other people feel bad, and they have a right not to feel bad. Never mind, they can do whatever they want. They have a right not to have somebody say something that makes them feel bad. That's oppression by ideology. So you can see now this is a different type of oppression, yet it's being done allegedly by a group of people who are identified as bad by their skin color. Well, this sounds like the problem they are trying to solve in the first civil rights movement, right? So what's up with that? And see, this is part of the problem. This is what I call... And what I'm giving you is a really quick summary, Cade, and you probably have a bunch more questions we might have to get to in another broadcast. But this is why I call it civil rights upside down, because what has happened now is there is a new bigotry, in my view, and the bigotry is by people who hold this view, who are have an animosity and a hatred for another, for people that are not in their group. Okay, and because of this bigotry, it turns out to be racism. So I am held to be evil because my skin is white. And that makes me a member of this group that is evil, so I'm evil. I'm the racist. And since that bigotry then leads to a racism, that means people can be prejudiced against me. They prejudge me based on the group, and they can discriminate against me, and then we have segregation all over again, and we do. That's why they have black, you know, they have black graduations at college and university. Just they have all kinds of segregation nowadays, and it seems just to be fine for people. So we've gone. This is why I say CRT or whatever you want to call it is the old civil rights movement completely upside down. Now, one last piece to the puzzle. You kind of with me so far, Cade?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, and you may have to listen to this again, and I realize I'm kind of running off here for the sake of time. Okay, how do you fix this problem? How do you fix this structural racism, structural oppression between two groups of people, the oppressed and the oppressors? How do you fix that? Well, this is what social justice is. And social justice is a way of evening out the playing field so that people who have less get more and people who have more have that taken away. So it evens things out. It's basically paybacks. Ibram Kendi says that you fight. How does he put it? I don't want to misquote him, but you fight prejudice with prejudice, I think is the way he puts it. Inequity with inequity or something. Now it's the whites' turn to pay since people of color have been paying for so long. So it's just a turnabout, in my view. It just amounts to a turnabout. Now we are going to justifiably oppress you because you have been oppressing us for so long. And that's what, this is my assessment, not just mine, but that social justice amounts to, all right? That's the solution, so-called social justice, but it isn't just. It's just retribution. You know, it's paybacks, basically. And if it was unjust in one direction, you don't solve or resolve injustice by a reverse injustice. You know, that's repaying evil for evil, in my view. And it's also, what's the commandment? Bearing false witness. It's bearing false witness against my neighbor. Because I'm accusing my neighbor of being something bad simply in virtue of some non-moral quality like skin color. So this is all part of the reason it's kind of really messed up. But there's one last thing. This is what a lot of Christians who care about justice don't realize with this broader CRT kind of paradigm. I think it's a Trojan horse. Because Christians are being brought into it because of the justice concept, and they love justice, and they want to oppose oppression. But it turns out, who are the ones that are the biggest oppressors on the system? Who are the ones that are oppressing women? Well, they're patriarchal people. Oh, or people who are pro-life. Well, who's that? Well, that would be like Christians. who are those that are oppressing, ideologically oppressing the gays? People who think that gays are wrong. That would be who? The Christians. What about transgender? They're being oppressed ideologically now. Nobody's hurting them. But there's, you know, ideologically, they're being oppressed because there's a group of people who think that God made male and female. Who's that? The Christians. And what about other religions? They're being oppressed because there's a religion who thinks it's right. So it turns out when you look at this bigger system, we are the worst offenders across the board. The most oppressive. We are the ones that are the bad guys, the Christians. And this is what a lot of people don't realize is the end game, really, I think, spiritually speaking, of this whole system. I don't think it's sound because I think the starting point, breaking society down into these two classes and making the one class, the ruling class, evil by definition and the non-ruling class good by definition, is not accurate. It's not accurate to history. And there's all kinds of other concerns, too. So I'm going to have to, Cade, I love having conversation with you, and I've just done all the talking, but I got three more people on the line here I want to try to get to. But what I'm hoping is that what I've done is lay a foundation for you so that you have, next time you call, we'll have a little bit more detailed conversation about particulars. What do you think?
That sounds great.
Okay. And I really had a great time meeting your family. And your brother, your younger brother, you're 14, right?
Yes.
I know listeners don't believe that, but I met you and I met your family, so I know you're telling the truth. You got a 12-year-old brother?
Yes, he's turning 12.
Oh, I get it. He was fudging a little bit, like, yeah, I'm kind of 12, right? So he's 11, but he has a chip off of his older brother's block, I'll tell you that. He's just like you, except for a smaller version. I mean, in the best sense. I mean, you guys are both so polite. You're thoughtful. You're easygoing. You're pleasant to be around. Anyway, I had a great time meeting your family.
Well, thank you, Mr. Coco. I really appreciate it.
All right, Cade. Thank you for your patience with me on this long explanation. We'll chat about this again, all right?
Sounds good. Thanks for your time.
Okay, take care, buddy.
Okay, bye.
Bye. All right. Yeah, I feel like I could have done the whole thing like twice as long and half as fast. That might have been easier for folks to understand. But anyway, that's my shot. Let's go to Katie in Las Vegas. Hello, Katie.
Hi, Greg. Good to talk to you again. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So I just want to tell you, feel good about what you just did, because I followed along fine. And I thought it was awesome. I'm glad you guys had that conversation.
Okay, good. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
So the reason I'm calling in today, you guys did a YouTube video or a podcast on YouTube where you were talking about Satan, and somebody had asked a question about, you know, why could the angels fall? And I had put in a comment that it was suggested to me maybe I should call in about it today. And I basically said, what do you think of this picture? It's just something that popped into my head as maybe this is possible. So tell me what you think.
Okay.
I was wondering if it's possible maybe Satan was the Adam for the angels, and he was given the same opportunity to choose as Adam.
Oh, I see. Oh, interesting. Okay, I see the citation, not the citation, but the characterization that Amy put up, and I couldn't make sense of it, but I get you. Like, we are fallen in Adam, and the angels are fallen in Satan, as it were.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let me tell you why I don't think that works. And the reason is because we are fallen in Adam precisely because Adam reproduces after his own kind. So when Adam and Eve fell, they became broken human beings, and they reproduced other broken human beings. Okay, so we share not just like a theoretical kinship with Adam, but an actual kinship with Adam. Okay, was the progenitor for the progenitors for the entire human race. We are their children, literally. All right, we came from them, and so when they reproduced us, along down the chain of descendants, they reproduced other human beings that were made in the image of God, but also broken and under the wrath of God in virtue of their fallenness. All right. But there is nothing like that with angels. In fact, Jesus, when he was asked about marriage in heaven, said there is no marriage in heaven, that they are like the angels. So the angels don't reproduce. It wasn't as if Satan was parallel with Adam in that he fell and then reproduced a bunch of fallen angels from his lineage. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. I didn't think, as a matter of fact, as soon as you said, you know, well, Adam and Eve had us as actual genealogical children, that's how it passed on. I thought, well, what if Satan had the angels? But you're right. They don't marry in heaven, so they don't reproduce.
There's no angel babies, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So now I do think that there's an insight, though, that you've offered here, because just as Adam is the head of the human race, after fashion, an important fashion, and there's theological ramifications for that, it does appear that Satan is the head of the fallen angel race. Not genealogically, but he's still the leader. He's in charge. He's the one who rebelled. And actually, we dealt with a question about this earlier today, Amy and I, and she was quick to point out on #STRask, that, you know, we don't have a lot of real clear information about this, so we're kind of speculative on some of it from some biblical references. But it seems like when he rebelled against God, that he was able to persuade other angels to rebel against God with him. And he swept away one third of the host of heaven, if I understand that line in Revelation accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And so they then followed that leader. So there's a sense that Adam is the leader of a human race, and the devil or Satan is the leader of the fallen angel race, but there is not a genetic kind of reproductive connection. There is just a kind of similarity in that regard. So that would be where the difference is.
On that line, do you think that there's any kind of, like, they talk about Christologies in the Bible all the time about, okay, well, this was kind of just God's way of showing how the whole story ties together. Do you think, I don't know what you would call it, a Satanology, that's weird, but do you think that there would have anything to do with showing how before we were here, there was a responsibility, there was a consequence for
rebellion.
The fall against God.
Yes. I do think that's the case. I think there's good reason to believe that, because there are a number of passages that talk about kind of the angelic realm that's watching what's going on, and what, as some would suggest, God is doing is playing out his justice and his righteousness, demonstrating it in the judgment against the fallen angels, which don't have any salvation plan. He's showing, is demonstrating his righteousness through what he is for those who are watching, through how he is managing mankind and the spiritual realm together. So, that was a very general statement. I can't get into details now, but I think that you're onto something there, Katie. Katie, I got to run though, and I thank you for your call. Hope that's helpful. I got a couple more people here in a very short time to work with here. Let's go to Jason in Lancaster, Ohio. Hello, Jason.
Hey, how you doing, Greg?
Good. What's on your mind? How can I help?
So I just wanted to let you know I appreciate all the work you're doing, and I'm 37 years old. I'm a firefighter paramedic, and got a couple kids that are kind of grown up. And a few years back, our chaplain at the firehouse started a Bible study and kind of got me back on the right path and trying to walk out my faith and things like that. And I started binging on apologetics material. I guess one of the promotional stuff we did was a psychological eval, and I guess I'm a detail-oriented introvert.
Oh, okay.
So I kind of ate that stuff up and never really approached Christianity through that lens. And so I started trying to prep myself for battle, right?
And, yeah, good sense, for you.
And to answer my kids' questions about different things. And everything changed when COVID-19 hit. And my wife kind of went down a conspiracy theory rabbit hole, to where she started to just doubt everything about scripture, of like, well, you can't trust the things that she didn't agree with because it's been tampered with. And the things she did agree with, she would throw in my face.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's... so really what my question boils down to is I've been trying to use these tactics to advance Christianity, but now how do you do that in your own home with your own family? And now, like, my kids are at risk because she won't let them get vaccinated. I can't. I try to use the tactics on her, and it's just like hitting a brick wall.
Well, now this is a marital discussion. So, and this is not my strong suit, I'll just tell you. But there's something that after 24 years almost of marriage, that is, and this is not profound, it isn't even unique to my relationship, so I'm not really saying anything about my relationship, I'm talking about marriage in general, is that people are individuals, all right? And you can appeal and can cajole and could reason and do the best you can, but people still make their own choices for their own reasons. Now, to some degree, we have, in certain relationships, as parents, we can exercise certain control. You know, we say, okay, you're not going to eat that. It's not good for you, but I want it. I don't like what the good stuff is. Well, that's not how it works here. Okay. You're going to eat the good stuff. And that's part of what parenting is to guide a child in a direction, you know, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, you know, kind of thing. And so they want all kind of foolish things. So we have an appropriate role in directing them and controlling them as parents. But when you get to an adult, that's a different story. And my girls are moving into adulthood. I have one turning 17 next month and one turning 14 next month. And so I can't force my faith on either of them. That is the substance of my convictions. I can reason with them, whatever, when they want to be reasoned with, but ultimately they have to decide for themselves. And when you have a spouse that disagrees with you, my conviction is that with regards to family issues, there is an appropriate place for the head of the household to establish certain boundaries. It's not always easy to figure out what those should be, but that's the job of the dad, you know, establish boundaries. But other than that, I mean, there are a lot of areas that are areas of personal freedom that you just can't dictate. If people, well, they're going to believe what they want to believe, then they're going to believe what you want to believe. Now, I will say this, maybe, and I'm revealing my own hand here a little bit, that that I do not think that your children, of course, I don't know how old your kids are, but how old are they?
Just
give me your ages.
18-year-old.
And?
18.
And?
14 and 3.
Okay, your children are not at any significant risk without it not getting the vaccine, all right? And I think...
I'm talking about any vaccine.
Oh, I see. Any vaccines. I thought you were talking about the COVID. Okay, yeah, well, that's a different thing. Then there could be risk of getting diseases related to those things that you get vaccinated against. That's a different issue. So, but you're the dad. So, okay, so here's my view, and I think this is biblical. Push comes to shove. You have one point of view. Your wife has another point of view. All right. And who is the tiebreaker? Somebody has to break the tie. Biblically, the husband breaks the tie. Now, having said that, there's a cost to doing that. Maybe. There may be a cost.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure that'll be the end of the marriage.
Oh, okay. If you decide to vaccinate your kids for smallpox or something like that?
I'm pretty sure down the rabbit hole she is.
Okay. Well, this is, you know, this is where you're going to have to do a cost-benefit analysis, you know, and I completely understand that. I am completely sympathetic. I know the way that is. And every married guy here who loves the Lord and understands God's plan for family knows this kind of tension, all right? Because human beings are human beings. And it's not easy to lead, and it's not easy to follow. But my view is, my conviction is that the Bible teaches that the husband is the head of the household. And when push comes to shove, he has the appropriate authority to break the tie, so to speak. However, if that comes at a great price to the marriage, that has to be taken into consideration. And also the risk to your children. I don't know that your children are at risk for anything but an uncomfortable time with certain diseases, unless it's polio. But that would be different. But anyway, there you go. Sorry, I can't be more precise. Tough situation, Jason. Hope that helps. All the best. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. That would be heaven. Bye-bye.